This is an oral history interview with Sharon Hutchinson, conducted by Crawford Young on the 23rd of July, 2013. Let's start with your early intellectual development. Can you say a few words about your family background and what kind of influence that had about your subsequent development, as well as your school years and particularly influential teachers?
Certainly. Thank you, Crawford. I was born in Mamaroneck, New York, my father was a mechanical engineer, and my mother had not completed but had started to study electrical engineering. My childhood was very happy up to perhaps the age of 7, when the family went through a trauma and my parents separated. They separated when I was 7, and they remained separated and not formally divorced until my first year at Carleton College, which is university. During that period, I was lucky because I was one of 5 children, so I had 4 wonderful siblings, and we worked together a lot. But every one of us in the family sort of were given certain roles in this wider unit. And my assigned role at a young age was that of messenger between my parents, because unfortunately they could not speak directly together without a lot of fireworks. And so, or going to court. And so this position was an interesting one for me, which I sank into. And I realized later on that it provided me with a great many experiences that later on were very helpful in developing me as a field worker and as an anthropologist. Because as I carried messages back and forth between my parents, the messages that were received were not always liked. And so I had to develop a strategy of trying to translate between 2 totally different worldviews and value systems, trying to be positive about both. So trying to translate my father's images and concerns to my mother's worldview and back and forth, while minimizing my own persona in the process. So this gave me, I'd say, a wider vision of what was going on in my family. I also had a lot of responsibilities very early, because for my mother, bless her heart, at the time she sank into a major depression and was incapable of parenting for many years. So we all live with my mother and we take care of that. In the long run, the situation was such that of the 5 children, only 3 of us managed to, shall we say, survive intact to adulthood. My oldest sister, for many reasons, had a nervous breakdown at 19, from which she never recovered. And my only brother, unfortunately, committed suicide at a young age. So within this context, survival was school. It was one of the places where I could go. People reacted rationally. I was deeply encouraged by teachers ever since primary school. I felt that if I did things, there were consequences that I could predict. And I loved learning. So I had many, I think from the time I went to school in kindergarten all the way through maybe the junior year of high school, I never missed a day of classes. No matter how sick I was, it was better to go to school. So I loved learning, and I had many teachers along the way who encouraged me, picked me out. I'm sure I responded very with a lot of gratitude. I had good in high school. It was a very large high school of 2,000 students, and there was a small group of perhaps 30 students that were sort of, we were streamed very directly, moved around. So I had a cohort of 30 students in all these different classes who were very competitive and liked learning. So that was all very good. And when it came then for time to apply for college, and I always thought that I would go to college, I picked picked a college that was very far away from my home situation, which was Carleton College.
Where was your home?
My home was in Mamaroneck, New York. And I actually couldn't afford to visit Carleton College before I went. I had some other acceptances. But I decided that that was a very good place to go. And there I met some wonderful, wonderful mentors. But I was, after my first year there, I had difficulties because Carleton College was wonderful at the time because they had a need blind admission process. Mm-hmm. So if you got in, they were going to find a way for you to attend. My family actually was quite poor, my father deeply in debt at that time. But unfortunately, to be able to take advantage of Carleton College's offer, it's necessary for your parents to sign the form that details their financial state. And because my parents at that point were going through a divorce, neither one was willing to sign this form for me. So I was stuck. I had worked all through high school, and I had some money saved up. So what happened was my father told me that he would pay for my first year at university. And then after that, I'd be on my own. So I went to the university, and the university was very kind. But at the end of the year, I was told that unfortunately my father had not paid anything, and therefore I would have to leave. So now I face the prospect of not only earning enough money to pay for my second year, but to earn money for paying for my first year. So I thought hard, and I had already met my future husband at that time, a man named Stephen Homdrum. He later changed his name to mine to Stephen Hutchinson, but his name at the time was Stephen Homdrum. And I went to work with a particular professor, Paul Reisman, who is a wonderful, wonderful mentor for me. And I tried to figure out a way that I could actually not drop out of school, but still maintain a way and give my father another year to at least get some money to pay for the first year while I earned money for the second. And the solution I came up with was to only be enrolled the second year for a quarter, because they had trimesters or whatever. And I would be in South Africa for the entire year, and I would do a research project in KwaZulu, learn Zulu as best I could and do this, and then bring it all back the following year, hopefully, where I could be, you know, admitted in good stead. And anyway, I managed to pull all of that off. And I managed to do my first field work in South Africa. Under the guidance of Paul Reisman. Now, I should explain that at that point, because it was a shock to me at the end of the first year there was no money paid, I had planned to go on to medical, pre-med. That was my goal in college. But at that point, that was no longer possible. And I also thought, well, anthropology, which I had never heard of before I had went to Carleton College, would be a lovely discipline as well. And so I made that choice. And after my year in South Africa, I was like 9 months there, I took three jobs in the summer, and I worked during school, and I managed from that point on to pay for all of my schooling out of my own pocket at Carleton. Now, I should let you know that that was a time in the 70s where that was possible. It was really possible. I think all of Carleton College cost like $3,500 a year. And if I worked three jobs in the summer, lived with my dad, I could save $2,000. I could work during Carleton intensively for $1,500 and come out basically with no major debts. Unfortunately, that's no longer possible. My daughter, for example, who went to Carleton College much later, her fees were $35,000 first year. And of course, at the time, no one child could make $20,000 in the summer. So I was lucky in that. And you know, at Carleton College, I found my first mentor. Paul Reisman, who worked among the Fulani in West Africa, was an extraordinary teacher. Not only did he allow me to write my first paper in anthropology about my family, which was an analysis of was called The Scapegoating of a Child, about, oh, why my sister, what was the family dynamics that made my sister break down. But he was open also to supporting me to go to South Africa to write a research on, basically it was a social change, again, among Zulu women who were both educated and both living in rural areas, and how they were coping and evolving. So it's a long-term interest of mine. Anyway, so after I was finished, Carlton, he encouraged me to consider going on in anthropology to graduate school. But of course, at that point, I was, of course, flat broke. And so I took off a year to go to Chicago to try to earn money, specifically to have enough money to start graduate school and apply. I also got married at that period to Stephen Holmdrum, later Stephen Hutchinson, who was going to pursue graduate studies in comparative literature. So after working for a year, I then applied to graduate school. And I was we had to juggle, because now we have family situation, have to juggle finding a graduate school that would serve both a good and comparative and for a field for my husband and good for a field for me. And it turned out the University of Chicago was a good situation. So entering the University of Chicago, there at the time I entered, I was not sure about, I wanted to do something vaguely in Africa because of my earlier experience in South Africa. And I naively, I saw that there was an African studies program at the University of Chicago. And I naively assumed that they taught some African languages, and that sub-Saharan African languages I was particularly interested in. When I went there, I discovered they did teach Arabic through the Middle East Studies program, but they didn't teach any sub-Saharan African languages. So I thought, well, okay, perhaps I'll work in Northern Africa. To cut a long story short, my first year there, I took Arabic as a language in addition to my core courses in anthropology. One of my core courses in anthropology was taught by Terence Turner, and it was called The Intensive Study of a Culture. And the culture he chose was the Nuer. So along with my cohort, large cohort of incoming graduate students in anthropology, we had a whole semester to delve deep to Evans Pritchard's corpus, and I expanded into Paul Howell's corpus, and all the research that had been done up to, you know, the end of the records at that point on the Nuer. I liked the course. I found that the Nuer is a fascinating aspects of this other society and culture, and I wrote a paper for the course that I then expanded into my master's thesis on gender relations among the Nuer, which is basically a reanalysis, like many others, about, you know, sort of re-looking at all of this research by Evans Pritchard and others to try to balance out a gendered perspective. And that later was published then through Africa and it won a prize. So I began there. Later on, while I was there, Jean Comaroff and John Comaroff joined the faculty, and I was very delighted about that. And I worked closely with Jean Comaroff particularly. My main advisor was actually Raymond Smith, who was chair of the department and worked in Caribbean kinship issues. And then my other member of the department, besides Jean Comaroff, was Nancy Munn. I found them all very helpful, but most helpful of all was because they allowed me to do what I wanted. At the University of Chicago at the time, for all its many merits, there was a good deal of, shall I say, I felt pressure for graduate students to adopt or a particular perspective or school of thought of how they should go about their analyses. When I started, it was in the thralls of Lévi-Strauss and then Marshall Sahlins and others. But my feeling about graduate school was that my professors are wonderful guides and they can serve that, but it is ultimately me who must pick a project that's going to keep my interests forever. And I was actually a bit leery of trying to conform to whatever particular, shall we say, school of theory was in vogue. And so I struck off on my own and decided that I wanted to study issues of culture and social change, which was not popular. And at the time, and then I would, you know, in the end, the professors have the right to sign or not sign my dissertation, but I'm the one who's going to determine its scope. And Raymond Smith was wonderful in that regard, very a loose rein, shall we say. So I went through my graduate school years there, and I needed funding. I was fortunate in the second year to win a fellowship for National Defense Foreign Languages at the time, which was later called FLAS, Fellowship for Arabic. And from that point on, that fellowship paid for my tuition, as well as a small stipend that allowed me to live and concentrate. I loved Arabic learning. It also gave me a freedom because my financing was not directly controlled by my senior professors. It was controlled externally through the Middle East Studies Department, and that was liberating for me as well. So after 2 years of Arabic study, I was I was their lead student. There's an exam you could take at the time, I don't know if it still goes on, to have a national exam to measure your Arabic knowledge. And if you get in the top 10 students in the country who take the test, then you get a full year of intensive Arabic study at the American University in Cairo. I was very fortunate to rank second on that. And so then I had a year to take off of classes to go and explore North Africa in some sense. So it was a very intense year in Cairo. All of our courses were in Arabic, all of our readings were in Arabic, all of our term papers were in Arabic. And in addition to I had studied sort of the standard, modern standard Arabic, but I had no familiarity with Egyptian colloquial. So we had a pre-summer of 3 months of learning Egyptian colloquial in Cairo and then the full 9 months of academic training in more modern standard Arabic. When I got there, it was the first time I'd ever been to an Arabic-speaking country. And I had gone there with the thought, well, okay, perhaps I can't study sub-Saharan African culture, but perhaps North African culture. But as a woman, as a year well on, and as a woman, I learned quite quickly that I did not have the full range of access, perhaps, of some of my male cohort in the group. Whereas my male cohort, it was perfectly acceptable for them to go to any cafe and sit and, you know, have a conversation with whoever was there. As a woman, in that context, it was much more difficult for me to do. And it was also difficult to sort of break through and to get into meet women in their homes. I was successful in some of this. I even lived with a family for a little while. But as the year wore on, I realized that if I was going to do my research for my dissertation in Egypt, I was really going to have to write about half a culture. Mm-hmm. I was never going to be able to have the full access that I would want, and I was interested in systemic change of cultures and societies. And so I began to rethink what I was going to do there. I had already written my master's thesis on gendered relations among the Nuer. And so I decided during that year, well, maybe I'll look around and see perhaps there's some Nuer in Cairo. And so I looked around and I found somebody who ended up being the first, who was at the at the University of Cairo in Arabic, speaking university, and he was studying for medicine, and he was actually one of the first, I think he was the first Nuer doctor to develop. So I sought him out, and we spent, because he spoke Arabic and I spoke Arabic, we could converse, and I showed him or walked him through my master's thesis and tried to get his reaction. Well, you know, what do you think of this? You know, what does this resonate with yours? And so we developed a relationship, and I felt very positive one. And so he encouraged me. He said, why don't you just take off a little bit of time from the Arabic program? We had a big winter break, and go down to South Sudan. I was, at that point it was Sudan, southern Sudan, and see what it's like. And so I did. In the middle of this break, I took a little longer holiday, and I flew to Khartoum. Then I took, it was dry season, so I immediately took lorries, these kind of lorries, the back of trucks riding the top of the lorries, that reached different areas, primarily central Nuer land. And I've traveled around for a number of weeks. And I was absolutely delighted by what I found. This had been after the first civil war, but before the second civil war, so people were still recovering. But in that society, because it's a very open one, and because men are constantly marrying strange women, or people cannot marry if they're kin or if they're close contacts or lots of things, so you're always looking for a mate outside your circle of friends and or at least kin, there was no barriers whatsoever to talking to people of the other sex, gender, in public. And so I went around, I stayed in people's little houses, I accepted hospitality, short periods of time, and although I didn't know any Nuer yet, my Arabic, there was usually somebody nearby who slightly maybe went to Khartoum for a few months to do as work as a part-time worker and came back, who I could converse through. And so I was delighted. I felt I could get a full view of the society. I could immediately see I had a good background from the University of Chicago about what the Nuer society was like when Evans Pritchard was there. And I could see tremendous potential for writing. And so I said, well, when I go back, I'll throw it up to the granting agencies and I'll apply for this project. And if I get money, well, then I'll be able to carry it out. So I returned to the University of Chicago after my program. I did finish my last year. I applied for grants, and I was very fortunate to get some. Basically, the Social Science Research Council was the one who was my main support throughout this period. And then shortly after that, I started working in the field. So to summarize my sort of pre-fieldwork days, I had many good mentors. Paul Riesman was an exceptionally supportive person. Jean Kubrov was always a source of dramatic and creativity and encouraged me to follow my own thought. Terence Turner introduced me to the Nuer as a subject and was always a source of interesting ideas. I worked on and off with John Kumaroff as well. And so these were some people that were critical. And Raymond Smith, of course, was my main advisor, and Nancy Bannon. So
in choosing the Nuer...
I'm sorry.
You want to stop it?
Just take a little break. Is that okay? I think I might have. I put it on hold.
Okay. It's not going now.
That was far more detailed than you need.
I was going to ask you about finding this domain that had been carved out, 40 years earlier by Evans Pritchard.
There's more than that.
Had become...
His field work is in the 1930s.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, 1930s.
Yeah, yeah, so...
Oh, you were, so, but so, you're now so in the 80s, so. Yeah. How Evans Pritchard served in a way as a kind of foil to your research. In the ways in which you, while of course respecting his work, also took issue with some of his perspectives.
Oh, well, that would be expected. but I can say something more.
Okay, so so that would be the next question, and then. Then we can go.
I didn't do anything about language learning in Neuer.
And you can bring the issue of language. And then we'll go to the family issues and the managing.
Oh, the family. Okay. Yes.
Well, both the two academic career dimension and then the childbearing issue. Now, while you were doing this. Field work, or this, you were already married.
Yes.
But your husband did not accompany you.
No, he came, I think, for a few weeks the first time, and
it was
impossible. Yeah. Because he had other things, and nobody wants to go.
Yeah, he was doing his own.
Yeah, exactly. He was writing his dissertation in Spain.
Yeah. His field was Spanish and Portuguese.
Field was actually comparative literature, but one of the fields within that was Spanish and Portuguese. And so when he went on the job market, he emphasized that part. But his degree is actually in comparative literature.
I see. So we would go from there to your two Yale years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now your husband, when did he finish his degree?
I think he finished 85.
Oh, he finished a little earlier.
Yes, because I was put back with
the
children.
You were taking care of children, plus the long field work.
Yeah.
Then
I think it was 80. Well, he started teaching here at the university in 85.
He came here directly.
Yes. He came directly. And
so
I came with him. I came with him.
Oh, so you
I was hanging out at university houses for those period of time. Teddy was born there.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and so then it finally, I came up, and so it was now, I had, supported him, and now it was time for me to launch my career. The children were old enough. I felt comfortable putting them in childcare. And then that's when I went on the market.
And then you wound up with the top job at Yale.
Yes.
But he was not at Yale.
So then,
he was
still here.
Married.
So then I gave him a fellowship, basically, to come out and join me while he wrote his book.
Well, I see. So he was on a Hutchinson research grant.
Yes. And so then he also, I think he might have had a minor, I don't know what he had, may have had something more, but basically he came and he stayed for part of the time. And then that first year he stayed with me and with the children and writing his dissertation. But this is another, but right before he left, he came down with a serious cancer of the colon. So he was 36, and so he had actually stayed behind to finish that operation. And then he came out later, lived with Mary Yun for 6 weeks, recovered, because I had to start Talas. That's a long story. And so then he came out, he had to recover, so I had to take care of him during that period, and then he finally got stronger. So yes, in addition to the starting at Yale, we had a recovery for him and then the children. And then, so he was going to look for jobs out there. He couldn't find one. And so then Yale was very disappointed because I told them, And then the second year I said, well, we'll try again. And that's when we both got jobs. He had one near me, and I had one near him. But anyway, I don't know if this kind of detail is important. So and then I got one here, right here on campus. And so then
He was still in...
He was still officially.
In the
second year he moved back.
Uh-huh.
He had the children. I stayed at Yale for one semester and then took a research leave to go to South Sudan for part of the second. Was it 90? Yeah, part of the time. Anyway, whatever. And so It's a long time ago. But basically, so we had a choice then. If he came to Amherst, University of Massachusetts Amherst, he would have to restart his tenure clock. And if I went to Wisconsin, then clearly, if I had stayed another year, I would have had paid leave and assorted other perks that were accumulating at Yale. So that was a choice between family, in some sense, career. And so I took the hit and moved
to Madison.
Yeah. So that's I don't know if these are other forms of experience. So let me just write down the quickest things. Undergrad, we did those key faculty influences. AU Cairo, we did that dissertation.
Yeah, you've done a very good job. I mean, my goodness. Usually I ask these questions myself, but you constructed your own narrative, which was extremely coherent.
And I hope.
It's excellent.
I think we need to do a little bit more about the dissertation, because one of the interesting things was, because I had a lot of senior colleagues at Chicago and beyond who warned me, basically, not to go study the newer.
Not to
go study the newer.
What, because of Evans Pritchard?
Yes. Uh-huh. But in addition to that, as it became clear, and I said submitting grants to some of these major granting agencies, they had readers often that were part of the secondary analysis cohort, shall we say, of Evans Pritchard. There was Tom Beidelman, Bill Ahrens. There was a whole series of professors in other universities who had not necessarily, I know for sure, had never spent any time in the region, but, you know, were making contributions to the discipline by reanalyzing Evans Pritchard's data, and they had their own debate and this and that. Mm-hmm. And so, so I had something about the extreme interest that was shown at that time.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I think you should say length of graduate study. We won't get to that. Let's just a few things that I would like to add, I guess. Language, fieldwork site choice, that's important. All of this would be pre fieldwork and wrestling to do work among the newer.
Mm-hmm.
And becoming somewhat high profile very early.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Mm-hmm. And then dissertation writing, length of dishes to.
Okay. So we're going to go back to the newer and talk about the language. Mm-hmm. We've talked about the field work site choice and Evans Pritchard and others working on newer and what you just mentioned. And then we can get into
the marriage career, and so
or maybe the length of graduate study can be when we talk about the family, the conflicting obligations.
Okay. It can be a transition into family.
Right. And under that, then you can also mention, because this business of commuting, marriages and whatnot, and finding jobs at the same place or very close together is also part of this challenge of young women trying to establish themselves in academic careers. You know, who defers to whom and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so ready?
Yes.
Let us pick up on the dissertation and your work among the newer. To begin with, there was the challenge of mastering language, which you've begun to refer to, and also by entering the ethnic domain of the newer, you move into under the shadow of a distinguished earlier British anthropologist, E. E. Evans Pritchard, that had established a kind of proprietorship over the field of newer studies. All these things interface with the issues of how you manage field work, dual careers, children, and so forth.
All right, thank you, Crawford. Why don't we just begin where I left off, which was sort of pre-dissertation research, a little bit more on that, because it relates to the questions that you're asking. I should say that when I began to apply for grants on the newer, it generated some extraordinary interest, I'd say. At that time, although Evans Pritchard's corpus had been closed for many years, there was a large body of, or a cohort of, professors in many different universities who had done some very creative work reanalyzing Evans Pritchard's data for theoretical purposes. Evans Pritchard's data was very convenient at the time because it was a closed corpus. And so now word was going out that there was a woman from the University of Chicago that was going to go back and study in southern Sudan what's happened to the newer since Evans Pritchard has been there. And this set, shall we say, some communications out there. And so as part of the getting the grant for the Social Science Research Council, some of these members of this group were on it. Ivan Karp, for one, was an important person. And as part of the grant that they gave me, to the credit, Social Science Research Council said, perhaps this woman needs a little bit more sort of support. And so we're going to send her, before dissertation work, field work, to see two people. One was Ivan Karp, who had done a lot of restudying of the newer, and the other one was Stephen Fireman. And so my first visit to the University of Wisconsin campus was under the auspices of the Social Science Research Council dissertation grant to come speak with Steve Fireman. And Steve, who I hadn't met before, but I gather was on the committee, was fabulous. He was extremely supportive, and he gave me some good tips. And for me, it created a very positive image of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, in particular their African Studies program. And so, but in addition to that, I also consulted with senior faculty at other universities, and I got a great many inquiries by some of these people that were doing reanalyses of the newer. So then I took all that information and I went to do the field work. I was already planning to do in-depth field work. My thought was, if I have to, you know, sort of walk in the shadow of Evans Pritchard, and Evans Pritchard has managed to write, you know, three major books plus dozens and dozens of articles, one dealing with basically the political, the environmental, you know, temporal, conceptual issues, one dealing with kinship, one dealing with religious issues. And many of these, many aspects of his work have been reanalyzed and they're out there in various forms. I'm going to have to know a lot about a lot of things. So I was determined from the start not to shorten my field work, but to take the full period of time necessary to not only get a good background and changes in everything, economics to politics to social organization, everything I could think of, to parallel at least something of Evans Pritchard, I would also make sure that I would perhaps expand a little further than Evans Pritchard, not only by delving deeply into kind of gender balance views of how the society's values are and priorities, but also to look at regional variations within the society. So I had decided in advance, Evans Pritchard, was writing at a time when His main goal was to try to, as best he could, he was his fieldworkers in the 1930s, really, as the New York just becoming fully conquered by the British colonial regime, his goal was to try to reconstruct, in some sense, a kind of pre-contact vision of the kind of whole of the society, and so his the notion of ethnography at the time was basically to pull out variations to try to create some kind of holistic vision of the commonality of newer culture or newer society. But throughout his books, there are fascinating little tidbits about major variations between the original homeland newer in the West and those who expanded during the 19th century eastward in a conquest of Dinka areas, Anuak areas. So throughout Evans Pritchard's work, if you look closely, you could see little tidbits of historical analyses. And Kathleen Goff, who was also one of these secondary analyses, the analyses of Evans Pritchard's work, wrote a brilliant article trying to foreground some of those differences. So I was determined when I went that I was not going to get sort of fall into the trap of trying to generalize about more than a million people over more than 60 years by sort of visiting one area, that I would spend at least a year in both, or try to spend a year on both Eastern and Western New Orleans to see also regional variations of language, culture, etc. So all of that was part of my goal. So when I went, I already knew Arabic because of my year in Cairo and stuff, although I had to learn. I started off doing the archives, both in Arabic and English, and at that time I hired a newer tutor in the hopes of at least learning the rudiments of the language while before I left my archival research to go down into the real field. But unfortunately, all I managed to learn from him primarily was Juba Arabic, which was another version of Arabic, but it was helpful. I learned some things. So when I got to the field, I was also sort of stubborn and determined to do my entire field research without the assistance ever of a field assistant and without the assistance ever of a translator. And so I realized this is also going to prolong my field of a new time. But so I went first to Eastern New Orleans, and even though I would speak in Arabic to other groups, because that's a lingua franca in the South with Dinka or Arab merchants, when it was with Newer, I would jokingly tell them that I didn't know any Arabic, that I wanted to learn their language. And surprisingly, and so I had a notebook. And everywhere I went, I would started off very, you know, writing down. I still didn't know all the grammar of the language yet, and I didn't figure it out, but I learned it totally in context. And as a process of doing that, I encouraged people, okay? And they were actually kind of proud. Here is this foreigner coming from far away. And I told them when I got there, when I first came to learn their language. And so that process was a very slow process, but I learned right away that the first 3 months, 6 months, most of these areas, they didn't have any Arabic speakers, especially out in the rural areas, maybe sometimes a little bit somebody who did some Khartoum stint of work as a migrant laborer. But anyway, so I had to learn completely in context. I started off with the young children, who are the only ones, I should say, are willing to actually correct your tongue. And learning from them, because they were teaching each other as well. And then I would slowly work my way up, you know, and the newer, you know, until old men with no teeth. And the newer would follow my progress. And they say, oh, now you're speaking like a 6-year-old. Now you're speaking like a 12-year-old. Now you're speaking, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But the true value of that, and I would advocate this for anybody who wants to really learn a language that sticks, is to circulate. So during those early months, I went on long walkabouts, backpack, just arriving in different rural villages. You can't, there's no advanced warning, right? And I would spend a few days, and so I would converse as best I could. And then you say something, and you get this very puzzled expression. looking at you, and you realized you pronounced it wrong or something said it wrong, and you would then try to twist it a different way, and then suddenly you'd say something, the other one would say, oh, and they would get the concept, they repeat it, and I'd repeat it after them, and I would write it in my notebook in front of them, etc., etc. And in that way, you don't get a lazy tongue. Because if I'm sure that if I had stayed in the same village to learn the language initially, they would have all learned my distorted tongue. And Noor had its challenges, aspiration of vowels, I won't go into it. So after that, then I did settle down in an area called Ulong, and I did research all of the region, all of Eastern Noor, over a period of about a year. And then I shifted to Western Noorland also. During this period, my husband at the time was pursuing his, did I put it in here? His PhD in Spain. And so when I became very ill or needed a break after 6 months of intensive, I would go to Spain briefly and then come back. So language is very important, field choice. Is there anything more I should add about that?
No, I think that's fine. And
I do remember one little thing. I'll just leave it at that.
So during this time, two children appeared on the scene. As you and your husband were pursuing your dissertation work, the issue of two academic careers versus holding a family together began to appear, as did the parenting obligations when your children appeared on the scene right after your field work.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak to the challenges that those issues posed for you and your family during the years from 1980 or so to 1988 when you finally finished your dissertation?
Yes, I'll be glad to. I saw... I tried to have a long-term vision of my life from the beginning. And I realized there was going to be great difficulties because of balancing career and family. But looking at the trajectory of anthropologist, or any academic for that matter, I realized that there is only really one kind of elastic period of time in one's in one's career. And that is the period of time after one's an ABD, or a dissertation, for my case, the University of Chicago. As far as the University of Chicago is concerned, after that point, all they want to see is a dissertation. And they're very flexible. They didn't have term limits in terms of how long you could write. And then the other starting point, of course, is when your dissertation is complete, because at that point, your career clock, as it were, starts ticking for tenure, early jobs, etc. So I did not want to get put in the position of having children while I was in my first jobs on the tenure clock. So I thought, well, this period between ABD and handing in the dissertation is the perfect time for me to have children. But I had already had a husband at that time, and so as soon as I was finished field work, that I immediately got pregnant with my first child. I could do some writing up during that period, but I was living at that time in Spain because my husband at the time was doing his dissertation research there. So after I finished my years in South Sudan, we came and we spent there a year. While I had my daughter was born in Spain, and so then we moved. He was finishing up his dissertation, and he was of course ahead of me because he had 3 years to write in Spain. And then we moved back to the University of Chicago for a year, and while he was a teaching assistant and he finished up his degree in 85. We had decided already that I was going to put a hold on my career for a number of years, and Stephen got a job, of all places, at the University of Wisconsin in Madison in Spanish department.
What year was that?
85. So we moved into university houses, and that, I can tell you, that was a huge blessing of this university all through my academic career, because by having a stable housing place that one could enter and exit pretty much at will, or at least a little advanced planning, made it so much easier to do field work and to do international research all the way along. So at that point, during that year, I got pregnant in 86. I gave birth to my son, Edward, better known as Teddy, and so I was at home trying to write my dissertation, but also taking care of two children that were below kindergarten age. That year we were quite poor, and to support a family on a junior faculty salary at the University of Wisconsin-Madison at the time was not easy, and so we could not afford any child care at all. I made some arrangements, some local women in the same university houses for a morning exchange for 2 hours a week, but otherwise it was a matter of me writing and coordinating the children's naps to get chances of working. So, but it was a happy time. I felt good staying home with the children. And I also had such a profound field work experience, and I felt so concerned because the war had started. We didn't get to talk about that. The war had started throughout as the field work was ending, and I felt a great commitment. So that never flagged throughout this long period of children's ear infections and other kinds of interruptions. So that took me several years to write the dissertation. I actually finished writing it in 87, and we decided I go on the, but I didn't defend it yet, because I wasn't going to defend it until I was going to go on the job market. So by 88, early 88, I decided it was my turn to take the lead now. Stephen was going to let me start to launch my career. And so I applied, and I applied, one of the jobs I applied to was at Yale University. And at Yale University, I thought I had a good chance, but I knew my chances would be greatly enhanced if I could, you know, have the dissertation fully defended. So I pressured my, when I got an interview at Yale, I pressured my faculty at University of Chicago to say that, look, let's just set a date and get this defense done. And so I did, and it was sometime in February of 88, and then within a matter of days, less than a week, I was interviewing at Yale. And so I was fortunate to get that position. I had already, so we had a family choice at that point. I had no position at Wisconsin, so the family decided that we would all move to Yale University, which I was fully intent on staying at. It was a tenure track position. And so my husband, Stephen, also joined us, and he basically received a fellowship from my position at there, so he could take the year that he was there at Yale with me and the children to write his dissertation and complete it as a book. And not a dissertation, sorry, to change the dissertation into a book, which he did. Within all of that period, there was a lot of juggling, but I would definitely say that I stepped back and put family first as the children were young, knowing that my career would only officially start when my dissertation went in. So I felt somewhat comfortable with the length of time. And when one has young children, there's inevitable interruptions. My youngest son, for example, at the age of 6 months, had an ear infection that became bacterial meningitis, and we spent 6-7 a week in the hospital. He was totally breastfed at the time. Clients, so you have these interruptions. But I didn't worry too much. So though now we're 88, I've gotten the job at Yale. We move out to Yale. At that point, unfortunately, right before we move out to Yale, my husband at the time had a severe medical issue, which he had an operation for which he had to spend a great deal of time recovering. So we had friends right at the start of Yale. So he came and joined us eventually, and we took care of him. And then at the end of that year, the goal was for Stephen to look for jobs in the same place near me at Yale. I was very happy there. He didn't manage to find one. So then we were at a real crunch. Two young children, both still in daycare, basically, under kindergarten. And do we move back to Madison with him? Do I take a leave of absence from Yale? Does he take another leave of absence from Wisconsin, because he hadn't given up his position? Do we? So what we decided to do was, I think I taught one semester commuting. We moved back to Madison. I taught a semester commuting, and then I had some fellowships from the university at Yale and others to do field work in South Sudan. And so that was another bout of field work. So we managed all of that. And we were also looking for jobs in the same vicinities. Second year of search, he came up with a job at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, which is in the region, but it's a commute. And I came up with a job offer at Madison in anthropology and African studies. And so there was a balancing issue again, because I was already farther back in my career. But for Stephen to take the job at Amherst, he would have had to have turned his tenure clock back to zero. And for me to have gone from Yale to Madison at that time, I only needed another year to get some very good perks, as it were, paid leaves, things, et cetera, from Yale. But the balance for me was the children. New Haven was not an ideal place to raise children. And Madison, which I had experienced before, while I was writing, and Stephen first was hired there, was a wonderful place. And so I was weighing in that way. But I made a point, because at the time I knew from inside sources at Wisconsin, including Steve Fireman, that I wanted to make sure that I entered the University of Wisconsin-Madison on my merits. And there was another category called spousal hire. And that spousal hire at the time was a nice idea, and I support it as a kind of concept. And what it did was try to give departments who could hire somebody who was a spouse normally of another department, but they could get a perk of a quarter position or a third of position or something. I don't know all the ropes of it. And so I was warned by Steve Fireman and my other mentors that I should make it a definite issue of this to make it clear that I knew I was their first choice, just ranked, without the spousal hire issue. So every single interview I went to, when I went on campus interview at Wisconsin, one of the first questions I asked is, if I were hired, would I be hired on my merits entirely, or would I be coming in under the category of spousal hire? And throughout this set of interviews, everyone assured me definitely that I was coming in on my merits, I was their first ranked choice, et cetera, and there was no way that I could be categorized as a spousal hire. At the time, Jan van Sinne was particularly supportive. I was very impressed, and I had always been impressed, by the African Studies program, Crawford Young. There were so many wonderful people there. And the African Studies program at Yale, although I should mention another person there who deserves great, great praise, was John Middleton. While I was at Yale, John Middleton was an incredible support, and he helped introduce you to many people internationally. He was incredibly supportive throughout my teaching, and within the African Studies program. But I saw Wisconsin's African Studies program as, in many ways, a more vibrant center at that time. And so the thought of moving to Wisconsin, I thought, aha, then I will have a whole bunch of Africanist colleagues as well. So I made the choice, and so that enabled Stephen to move towards tenure sooner, and for me to begin then my tenure clock again. But I can't remember if I got 2 years or what I got, but I don't remember. But and so that's sort of those choices. Later on, there are other choices as well, but I don't know if you want me to talk about them here or in some kind of chronological order.
Go ahead, and while we're talking about family dilemmas,
okay,
and gender issues.
Yeah, I was happy at Wisconsin. I had, you know, more field work. We can talk about all of that, and I. Teaching, etc. But at a certain point, family issues rose to the front again. I have to approach this because now there's a chronological and now the.
This is what comes to the divorce issues.
Yeah, but before that, here you have this interlude of Yale experience, hiring at the top.
Let's do newer dilemmas, and then the Civil War issues. By the way, did you have your children with you?
I have never taken my children.
No, I can't.
I've taken them to Senegal. I've taken them, you know, to many places in Europe. I've taken them to Australia. I've never taken them to South Sudan.
Let's pursue the newer issue in the sense that once you have. In this, with this gigantic effort, really, mm-hmm. To master the language in its regional dilemmas. Just out of curiosity, is Noor close enough to Dinka?
No, they're not mutually intelligible. They cannot.
Yeah.
And in fact, many of the words, you know, that, you know, have a meaning in both,
uh-huh.
One for woot, for example, might mean in Noor it means a man.
Yeah.
In this one, it means cattle camp. So you cannot trust, you know, homonyms of any kind.
Well, you, because of the depth of your work and the influence and impact of your terrific book on newer dilemmas. You become, in a way, connected in an enduring way to newer, and it's not easy to imagine going through that same process in some totally different cultural setting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, to put it crudely, a sunk intellectual capital that are inescapable. And then the renewal of the Civil War, which when you were doing your field work, perhaps mm-hmm. you didn't mm-hmm. necessarily
did.
Anticipate.
Oh, I did.
Then creates new challenges and difficulties. You can't abandon the newer, even if you were wanted to do so, which you didn't. And then because of the Civil War situation and this whole effect on newer society, then that reinforces the sense of obligation and commitment and whatnot to the group. So it leads you to explore, you know, what happens to gender in this these conditions of endemic, unending sometimes low intensity, sometimes very violent civil conflict. And the militarization of society, it's not on.
Oh, well, you should have all this on.
It's when this bottom light is on that's recording.
Okay.
Okay, now it's recording.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry for that.
So let's talk further about the...
Oh, maybe it's... maybe you should... Because I had a hold on the right here. Uh-oh, I hope we didn't not record anything.
Okay, it's recording.
But I don't...
The clock is ticking.
Yes. Okay, I hope that hold I had on the right did not... it was recording
that'll
before.
Turn it off, but you didn't hold it down long enough for it to turn off. Just do this button.
Okay, Crawford, I'm fearful that the hold was a flip up and it stayed off for much of that.
No, it would would say goodbye,
okay.
See you if
okay,
it
wonderful.
Turned off. So
anyway, so I hope I don't have to.
No, we do. No, I'd
okay, but
have the same hope. Have this feeling that
yeah.
Is it working?
All right, let's
Let's talk further about the Newer Dilemmas book that was the ultimate product of your dissertation research, and it's gained wide recognition. It's won different prizes and has made an enormous contribution to the field. And in particular, in certain respects, it does challenge some of the earlier work of Evans Pritchard. If you could say a little bit about what you regard as the principal contributions of the book, of your work with the Newer. And then, shortly after you ended your field work, or I guess just before you ended your field work, the Civil War broke out again, and then continued until 2011. A whole new set of issues arise as to how endemic civil war affects gender relations, how it results in a kind of militarization of society, and so forth. So perhaps you could say a few words regarding your thoughts on those issues.
Yes. I can do it a little chronologically, because then I'll be able to keep it straight myself. I made the decision to study the Newer of Southern Sudan with the knowledge that I had this huge resource of information from which I could draw to have a comparative temporal view of the society as it moved through. In Khartoum, I wanted to mention one mentor that I had at the beginning of my fieldwork, which was Abdul Ghaffar M. Ahmed, who was at the University of Khartoum at the time, who was extraordinarily helpful in helping me jump all the hurdles to actually move from Khartoum down into South Sudan, all the permissions from the government. Mm-hmm. In any event, I had this big bout of information, and we discussed language learning, we discussed field choice, I had a long period of field work. So for the moment, I'll just talk about some people who might look at my career. They might say, why has she continued to do research in Southern Sudan, now South Sudan, for such a long period of time among the Newer, when she could easily have perhaps shifted to new areas or found some comparative point of reference, etc.? Well, this is an interesting question, but it comes down to this. Of course, there is a tremendous amount of information in doing kind of old-fashioned field research. I mean, if you think about it, to do the work among the new, I had to invest in two languages, okay, to a great deal, to become fluent enough to carry out interviews without any kind of assistance. I also had to, you know, get to know a great many people in there, and their personal commitments, or at least a knowledge of people's situations. Throughout my initial field work between 80 to 83, I was profoundly aware that a war was brewing. It felt, as I was in the field, that one could see this huge thundercloud gathering and gathering and gathering on the horizon. It was going to roll over these people. And there's nothing I could do about it and nothing they could do about it. And my question, a selfish question at the time, was, you know, can I actually develop enough field research to get out in time before the whole thing blows to actually complete a dissertation and a book the way I like? So that brings up to 83. And of course, by 83, the violence began, and the very first place it struck was where I lived for a full year, my second year of field research, in a place called Far Loal, with a wonderful family of an earth priest and paramount chief of the Lake Nur. And so I knew for a fact that the area I was most intimately in contact with this last year of field work was the first to go under. People scattered. I was, of course, giving birth to children between 83 and 88, you know, I had all of that sort of work. But when I was always kept very close tabs with people as best I could. There was no mail coming out, but I was following all the information. And so I was determined to return to the field area. And my first possibility of doing that was in 1989. And this was the year that Omar Hassan al-Bashir first had his coup d'etat. And I was at Yale at the time, and I had some research grants from them. And I went to Khartoum because it was impossible at that time to get into southern Sudan and the war zone itself. And I got in there at a time, just a few months after the coup, and when no journalists were admitted, no other researchers, no human rights worker. And actually, I know for a fact that I was the only one at the time. At that point, I was already working closely with Human Rights Watch people, Amnesty International, all kinds of human rights people. And I think the reason I got into Khartoum is because I wrote a letter on Yale stationery saying that one of my objectives was not only to establish contact with some of my newer friends from previous fieldwork who are now in Khartoum, but also to strengthen relationships with the University of Khartoum and Yale University. Okay, and that was true. So when I got there, my colleagues and friends were now living, many of them were in shanty towns, and they were being bulldozed daily. And I was suddenly thrust into a very intense experience of seeing the, shall we say, the splash out of the people that were coming out of South Sudan as refugees in their own country. So that commitment was there. I began working closely with human rights organizations. And in fact, from that point on, through all of my fieldwork, I became very closely involved, because often in doing my fieldwork then, in Khartoum and subsequent, there was much information I collected that was far too hot for me to publish under my own name. And so much of this information could be passed to other organizations who combined it with other information, evaluated it independently, and then, you know, published it in their own documents. So that was going on. So there's a commitment there. There was a commitment. I started going back to the field again in 92, and at this point, the SPLA had split, and there became a big Nur-Dinka divide, which also created a kind of existential crisis in my research. So I went back in to see there was a partial peace agreement, and newer regions were suddenly now related to Khartoum, and new forces were coming in directly from Khartoum under the guidance of Riek Machar. That also, that information, but there was like a commitment that grew, that a feeling of they were beginning to get some international humanitarian agencies started coming into some Norwegians by 1991 as a result of all kinds of historical events. At that point, many of them were beginning to write to me or contact me to ask for some guidance and whatever projects they were putting in newer regions. And so in addition to the human rights people, then I got involved with the international humanitarian organizations. And that was very critical for my research of returning to the field. And that was critical because at that point, it was absolutely impossible to get in the southern Sudan unless you flew in on one of the planes that was at that point under something called Operation Lifeline Sudan, which was organized in northern border of Kenya, but permitted all of these planes to go in. And so at that point, 92, my research broke wide open because I could go to many different areas of Nuerland. I never knew which one would be totally overrun by war when I finally got there, but I could go over. And so all of those things created in me a sense of a commitment because there was a feeling that there's all this suffering, all this dying, all this courage, all this resilience, all this also perseverance that was not getting a documentation. You might ask, well, why couldn't the international humanitarian organizations or their people write some of this information? But the bottom line is they couldn't, because they were only there with permission via Operation Lifeline Sudan, and Khartoum's permission had to come to. So if they spoke up or wrote up too dramatically, then some of that information might cause the government to kick them out, depending. So I continued to go there, but there were certain angst that were developed when the split of the SPLA occurred and suddenly rapidly escalated into a major kind of inter-ethnic divide. I had to face some questions in my own research. I was somewhat comfortable, you know, using the concept of newer, with very nuanced elements of Eastern, Western, past, present, gender variations within this kind of general concept. But when this thing exploded and the militarization of the society, which is another project I studied very dramatically and deeply, began to develop, I became uncomfortable. And I began to realize that this category of the newer was becoming a new, was now becoming an obstacle for peace on the ground itself. And so to what extent do I want to continue using this concept, knowing that is it reinforcing now a kind of representation that's becoming an obstacle? And if so, how am I going to handle this situation? I thought long and hard. And what I eventually did is I teamed up with another anthropologist, this time a Southern Sudanese anthropologist, Dr. Jok Madut Jok, who is an extraordinary colleague and now runs the Sud Institute in southern South Sudan. He and I got some joint grants together through the Harry Frank Guggenheim Foundation to do parallel field work in the areas where the Nuer and Dinka had to pull back from their borders, and there was no longer, suddenly for 8 years, people that were interacting and chiefs and everything, suddenly on pain of death by the military on both sides, could not talk to each other. Mm-hmm. We went for 2 summers, parallel field work. And then he got the vision from his side, I got the vision from our side, and we wrote joint articles talking about both sides. And even within that, there were a lot of ethical dilemmas. Do we talk about the stereotypes that are being cultivated directly to try to maintain the military's control of these regions, or do we not? Do we, you know, how much do we self-censor ourselves? And to what extent does self-censorship, you know, when does it become complicity? How do we handle the military warlords who we have to at least work around, if not through, to go back? So all of these issues. And as that went on, my research, it was like, it was always sort of, the inspiration for it was never sort of coming out of where were the theoretical trends of anthropology or anything else. My attitude, and I forgive me for being so blunt about this, is theoretical leading edges will come and go. Theory will come and go. But if you can do incredibly grounded, detailed field work, that's immortal. It will always be there. And so I always took my inspiration from the people I was working with, even in Your Dilemmas. All of the chapters are about debates that were going on in the society themselves about things that were changing and they didn't know what to do about. So as the war went on and there were different phases, I too adapted with them. Later on, I became more involved in, my last 6 months of fieldwork in that area was in 2002-2003, and that's a while back, and we can talk about that. But the reason I served on the Civilian Protection Monitoring Team on a frontline mission for the State Department, which was a totally different experience, but again, gathering information, which now presents a rather massive archive of war issues affecting all of southern Nuer regions, some regional ones as well, including oil issues, etc. And so there was a commitment there, and I felt that it was best served. So why did I continue to study the Nuer? Well, I was interested on a theoretical level of, you know, processes of systemic change, global change. And here, could I find a better place where all of the global forces of, you know, war and refugees and independence and politics and economic transformations, human rights issues? I mean, this was and continues to be a flashpoint in the world. And so there was sufficient to keep me interested. But as I went on continuing my work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison teaching, also modulated along with my interests. When I first came to the university in the department, they seemed to have a few core courses that had to be covered, but otherwise people just sort of taught what they wanted. But I realized there are major gaps, and I think over my career, I think I've taught many, many, many different courses I taught. But as time went on, I modulated more into international humanitarianism courses, human rights courses, even Islam in Africa courses. I did this because I realized that students needed and wanted courses where they could, you know, relate to global issues taking place to in their own world and in foreign worlds. And anthropology is the place to do it. It's so wide open. And so those modulations came as well. So I could say that in my career, that had many turning points, although my fieldwork rigor and appreciation for doing what I considered in-depth fieldwork remained constant, it was overlaid, as the society itself was overlaid, by new pressures of global pressures and new forces from outside and their own wars, and became more humanitarian, more of an activist, sometimes advocacy role. And there were other points where Sudan itself became very important and central, whether the Darfur situation, where I, merging in 2003, did a lot of work on that. And then later on, becoming part of the government, U.S. government, a source of resources for the diplomatic corps in some sense.
Among other things, you've had some involvement in the post-peace settlement work, and mm-hmm. some work that you did with the UN.
Yeah.
Could you
yes.
say a few words about that?
That's the most recent work. Well, of course, everybody was delighted with the independence of South Sudan that made it so peacefully initially. But not long after that, some of the tensions that had been building up within internal to the society, which the Sudan People's Liberation Movement had not moved rapidly to address, shall we say, during the interim period of where 2005-2011, where the North and South were nominally united. And so these began to resurface. And one of the key areas of that was in central newer regions of what's called the Jonglei state, and particularly on the borders between the Lao Nuer, Eastern Gajok Nuer, to the Murle and Dinka. And for details I won't go into, became an extraordinarily explosive situation, which the UN could not handle at all, it seemed. The UN, of course, kept major peacekeeping forces there, and of course the UN looked to the government, new government of South Sudan, to protect its own people. But there was a series of situations that culminated, I don't remember now, 2012, 2011, where basically, I can't remember exactly now, something called the Nuer White Army, which I know a lot about, basically flashed onto the global scene by announcing that they were going to march across the savannas of Jonglei to basically annihilate the Murle people in revenge for previous attacks by the Murle on them, which were not answered or responded to by the central government. And so at that point, yes, I was called to assist, give some guidance on that. I can't say that the situation has resolved itself by any means, but I was pleased because once I went to talk to other people involved in this, I began to appreciate, perhaps in a way that I didn't, the deep historical knowledge of the region, so that at the time some of these people, the UN assistants of theirs and an NGO, they really had no idea how peace conflicts between the Murle and the Nuer were resolved before this explosion or before the war. It was an interesting exercise.
Let's turn to your relations with the African Studies program. Mm. You've been an active member of the program since you came. You organized a major colloquium for us on Southern Sudan in late 90s. Then you served for 2 years as director of the African Studies program. What role has the African Studies played in your Wisconsin career?
Oh, it's been wonderful. As I explained earlier, they are one of the main draws of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, from my perspective, was the strength and stellar quality of the African Studies program here. And they welcomed me right away because I became here, I think, in 90. By 1991, I was made a symposium chair for a symposium that took place in 92 called Ethnicity, Nationality, and Polity, the Changing African Landscape. So I felt they gave me room to sort of participate. I had actually 4 major conferences I organized at my period here at the university. There's one on gender militarization in the nation state, which was a Ford Foundation grant, one for women's studies, but also involved a lot of Africanists. And then the 2 that I organized while I was director, right, one before director, 2007, Sudan's Defiance of International Human Rights Symposium, the African Studies one, and then in 2008, Africa Encounters Global China was the spring symposium for the African Studies program too. So they gave me lots of resources there. I every year I was on some committee or not, but they were spared me a lot of that. I have listed them somewhere. But for me, it was the colleagues. My curiosity, intellectual curiosity, stems to many different fields. Political science, you know, even psychology, you know, sociology, and religion. And so with the African Studies program gave me colleagues within a broader breadth of things. Plus, they gave me access. They gave me every year, you know, if I wanted to go, I could go to the African Studies meeting. They'd help pay for a plane flight. That was very important to me. And I would go, I had to alternate with anthropology because they're always like at the same time pretty much, or I couldn't afford both. But anyway, so that was a source of tremendous delight because it was, well, many people, Jan Vansina, Of course, Hugh Crawford were a credible source of support. Stephen Fireman, when he was here. Later on, Florence Chenoweth, who in a later period, while I was chair, director of African Studies, she was a wonderful colleague and support, and we developed some course together. Heinz Klug, Amy Stambach, Gay Seidman, and there are so many. Ali Tripp was just amazing, a colleague. Teju Olanian, Lisa Naughton, Tom Spear, very big support. Later on, of course, they brought Kendall and Claire Wendlin. Rich Walston was a very nice support. Idris Makwit. So there's just an endless number of positive people who I felt, in some sense, compensated sometimes for things within the department which were not always as supportive, shall I say. So there was that. I took on the directorship more as a sense of responsibility, you know, doing my turn. I don't think leadership positions are necessarily my forte. But I did the best I could, and then